This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, a human rights group reacts to the Islamic State's weapons supply. A lesson in grief for San Bernardino, California shooting victims.
When something like this happens, they don't feel it right away. I know they don't. It's like breath being taken from you. The minute it settles in, that's when you have to come in and not be peacemaker, but show that there is peace in front of this.
Time magazine picks its person of the year and will tell you how they do it. Country music superstar Dolly Parton gets the TV movie treatment. These stories and more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter says the international community has to step up the fight against Islamic State before another terrorist attack like last month's Paris assault. Testifying before the Senate Armed Forces Committee Wednesday in Washington, Secretary Carter urged Turkey to do more to control its often porous border with Syria and criticized Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states for being preoccupied by the conflict in Yemen. He also said it is time for Russia to, in his words, focus on the right side of this fight against the Islamic State. Meanwhile, rights group Amnesty International says the arms used by Islamic State fighters were largely seized from Iraqi military stockpiles. International Edition Susan Yaki spoke about the finding with Amnesty's advocacy director for the Middle East and North Africa, Sanjeev Berry.
Amnesty International's latest report documents how decades of irresponsible weapon sales from Russia, China, the United States, and over two dozen other countries to Iraq have created the environment in which the armed group that calls itself Islamic State is able to acquire weapons through looting Iraqi storehouses of weapons and use those weapons to enlarge its power in the region.
How is it getting it from Iraq into where they're fighting in Syria and Iraq?
Well, one of the major ways in which the armed group Islamic State is getting the weapons is simply from deserting Iraqi soldiers who have left them behind on the battlefield as Islamic State swept across parts of Iraq in 2014. In addition, however, there are black markets, there's corruption, and the United States and other governments have done a very poor job of ensuring that the Iraqi security forces and the Iraqi government have the system set up in place to make sure that weapons that are sold to the Iraqi government don't end up in third-party hands.
What can really be done about this?
Well, the first step is to adopt a posture of presumption of denial. That means that when the U.S. or other governments are receiving requests for more weapons from the Iraqi government, the Iraqi security forces, or other groups in the region that are allied with these governments and involved in the conflict, that the presumption should be on not providing any more weapons unless the recipient of the weapon can clearly show that that weapon's not going to fall in the wrong hands or be used in ways that violate human rights or international humanitarian law. So far, arms suppliers like the United States, Russia, China, and others have failed to do that, and as a consequence, we are seeing the eruptions of violence in which the armed group Islamic State is able to pick up more and more weapons as it expands its territory.
Amnesty has long spoken out about the atrocities caused by Islamic State.
Absolutely. The armed group Islamic State has been involved in crimes against humanity by systematically targeting civilian populations. You know, we've documented reports of sexual slavery, of all sorts of horrific forms of violence. And it speaks to the underlying problem in which rushed efforts to provide weapons to quote-unquote allies without concern for human rights end up creating larger problems in the longer run. And there's a significant risk that if U.S. policymakers simply repeat that approach in the Middle East today, there are going to be more whirlwinds of violence that will erupt in the days and years ahead.
Do you think the United States should put boots on the ground, so to speak, in that region?
You know, Amnesty International doesn't take a position on whether or not particular governments or parties should get involved in armed conflict. Our basic approach is to say that all parties to an armed conflict must follow the rules of international humanitarian law, including the rules of war as well as human rights law. In the armed conflict on the ground there today, there are multiple parties that have violated international humanitarian law and human rights law, and those parties should not be getting any weapons.
Sanjeev Berry, Amnesty International's advocacy director for the Middle East and North Africa, speaking with International Edition Susan Yaki. The head of the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation says the two shooters in last week's California massacre were radicalized before they met online and started discussing jihad and martyrdom about 2 years ago. FBI Director James Comey told the Senate Judiciary Committee Wednesday that Syed Rizwan Farooq and his wife, Tashfeen Malik, were radicalized for quite a long time before carrying out the attack in San Bernardino, California. The pair killed 14 people and wounded 21 during a gathering of local government workers at a regional center in San Bernardino, east of Los Angeles, last week. They fled in a car and were gunned down in a shootout with police in a nearby residential neighborhood. The mass shooting in San Bernardino is a stark reminder of the toll taken by gun violence in the United States. The Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence reports that on average, almost 300 people are shot every day in America, of whom 89 die. The numbers are more than just a statistic to one man who seeks to support the survivors of this recent tragedy. VOA's Kane Farabaugh has details.
Diamond Mendez feels it is important to show his support to the victims of the San Bernardino mass shooting, in part because of his own family history.
My father was murdered when I was 3 in Las Vegas. My grandmother was taken from me. 3 years ago, my cousin, Keith Lawrence, and Monica Kwan, his fiance, were murdered by Chris Dorner.
The 2013 manhunt for Christopher Dorner in Southern California dominated news headlines. In an act of retaliation after he was fired by the Los Angeles Police Department, 33-year-old Dorner ambushed Mendez's cousin Lawrence and his fiance Kwan, who was the daughter of a retired LAPD captain. Dorner later died in a standoff with law enforcement. When the San Bernardino shootings unfolded on December 2nd, Mendez recalled it was just one day shy of the 22nd anniversary of the burglary gone wrong that ultimately claimed the life of his father, Tracy Lee Lawrence.
He was shot, I think, 17 times or something, but he didn't die because of the bullets. He died because of a blood clot on Christmas Day, weeks later. So they attempted to kill my father, but I knew God had a reason for him not to die on the spot because, you know, he reconciled with us.
As Mendez watched the events in San Bernardino unfold on TV, he began to wonder if the victims had the opportunity his own father had in the final moments of his life.
Did they have time to reconcile? Did they go to work upset? And a lot of people don't know if it's going to be their last day or not.
Which is what brings Mendez here, to the expanding makeshift memorial for the victims and survivors of San Bernardino's tragedy. He says he's here to listen, to pray, but most importantly, to let those suffering know he is someone who intimately understands their grief.
When something like this happens, they don't feel it right away. I know they don't. It's like breath being taken from you. The minute it settles in, that's when you have to come in and not be peacemaker, but show that there is peace in front of this.
He says his advice to those enduring the intense grief in the wake of these attacks comes from a place of understanding.
This will get better only because there's joy that comes in the morning. And I'm not talking about daylight to darkness to daylight, but the morning, the shedding of the tears. So it's okay to remember them and to mourn, but there will become love and peace from it.
A peace that the victims and the community of San Bernardino still search for after the event that transformed their community. Kane Farabaugh, VOA News, San Bernardino, California.
International negotiators in Paris have released a new draft of a global deal to fight climate change. It's a draft that removes some issues of dispute but leaves others unresolved. The negotiators are trying to finalize a deal by Friday when the Paris Climate Conference, also known as COP21, is scheduled to end. The unfolding climate drama also is a subject of this week's hashtag VOA TV show. And its host, Michael Lippin, is here in the studio. Michael, who did you have on your panel this time?
Hi, Ray. Well, I can tell you that I spoke to 4 environmental activists in the show about the progress that's been made so far in Paris and what has to happen next in the struggle against global warming. One of the panelists who joined via Skype from the Paris talks is Michael Jacobs. He's a British economist and senior advisor for the New Climate Economy Project. I asked Jacobs why it's so important for the more than 180 parties at the talks to reach a deal together.
The difficult thing about climate change is that it is a global problem which only if all countries act together can we solve. No country, even the US and China, don't produce enough emissions on their own for their own action to be sufficient. So all countries have to do it, which is why you need an international agreement to ensure that everybody is acting. But of course, it's really important then that the two largest countries are committed to doing so. So what we have in Paris is now a coming together of all countries to take action. And already, even before Paris, we arrived at the conference itself, 183 countries had published their emissions reduction plans and targets for the future. And that is indicated that countries do want to act on climate change. They all understand now how serious this is going to be for our economies and for our lives. And that is why there is tremendous goodwill here to try and reach an agreement.
I also spoke to Kelly Levin of the World Resources Institute via Skype from Boston. Levin attended the first part of the conference, and I asked her what kind of support developing nations will need to fulfill their climate commitments.
So I think that developed countries have acknowledged that they do need to take the lead, that there's also a push to get increasing numbers of new actors involved, both the private sector as well as new countries involved in giving support. And the support needs to be on all different levels in terms of finances, capacity building. And when we think about capacity building for tracking progress in MRV, it is also about collecting data at the national level, being able to do trainings in terms of methodologies of how to quantify impacts of policies. And it's across a whole number of different suites of activities that will make implementation a reality as well as one that can actually be tracked and reported back to the international community.
Michael, I understand there are two other panelists in the show who are specialists in green energy projects. Who are they and what do they have to say?
That's right, Ray. One is Dan Gilbo, who works for the Washington, D.C. Department of Energy and Environment and who was in our studio. And also we had Mark Ginsburg of the U.S. Green Building Council, who spoke via Skype from Paris. Now, the U.S. Green Building Council runs a rating system for buildings around the world called LEED, which stands for Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. Here's what Ginsburg had to say about the global progress in adopting the LEED system.
Well, I think there's a great spirit of wanting to follow the precept of if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. And so LEED is a system that helps cities and companies and organizations know how they are progressing in their energy consumption, how they compare with other building owners and operators. And so it gives them a real tool to help them know how to implement energy efficiency in their buildings.
And back to Dan here in the studio, how common is LEED certification in Washington?
It's very common in D.C. I think one of the most exciting things about D.C. right now is that LEED and other ratings programs have really just been embraced by the private building sector. So really, you just don't see Class A buildings being built that aren't LEED certified because there's such strong demand. And we're not talking lower level certification. It's among the higher levels of certification that really is being built right now. So it's very, very popular.
Well, for more on the show, you can actually watch it on our Facebook page. Just go to Facebook and search for hashtag VOA. Ray?
Thanks, Michael. Coming up, how Time magazine picks the person of the year. This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
It's the spacecraft which will hopefully help clear up the cosmic cloud of mystery that surrounds space, time, and gravity. The European Union Agency's LISA Pathfinder spacecraft was launched on the 2nd of December. Its mission, to prove once and for all Albert Einstein's theory of general relativity, or E equals MC squared. His theory, shared with the world 100 years ago, says that to account for gravity, time and space must curve around massive objects like stars, planets, and black holes. This curvature should show up as ripples in the fabric of space-time. These ripples, or gravitational waves, are very faint, and the LISA Pathfinder will test technologies that could one day detect these waves. If this first mission succeeds, there'll be a much bigger mission involving three spacecraft to finally detect the one constant of the universe, gravity. For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grossons.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. Time magazine named German Chancellor Angela Merkel its 2015 Person of the Year. The publication noted her leadership during the Syrian refugee crisis, the Greek bailout agreement, currency turmoil in the European Union, and Russia's intervention in Ukraine. Radhika Jones is deputy managing editor of Time magazine. She spoke with International Edition's Ira Melman about the selection process.
The criterion is the person who, for good or for ill, most affected the news and our lives. And in looking at some of our top contenders, at Donald Trump, who's certainly dominating the American news cycle right now, at the leader of ISIS, at Hassan Rouhani of Iran, who is striking a moderate tone amid the progression of the nuclear deal, we felt that Chancellor Merkel really had risen to all of the challenges that came across her desk this year, and there were many of them. She's been in office for 10 years. She is the steward of the world's fourth largest economy. But this year in particular saw her taking a leadership role, not just in confronting the serial debt crises that the Eurozone has faced, but also leading the response to what was the biggest migrant crisis since the end of World War II. And our feeling was that whether you agreed or disagreed with her decisions, and she, many of her decisions have been controversial, it was impossible to deny that she was having a major impact on the lives of millions of people.
What goes into the selection process, and how close was it with the runners-up?
We hear a range of suggestions, and I mean the full range. Time is a general interest news organization, so we cover not just politics and world news, but technology, business, sports, entertainment. And our feeling about Person of the Year is that influence ranges widely, and our best candidate could come from any one of those fields. I would say this year, because of the tumultuousness of the news, and particularly the migrant crisis this fall and more recently the attacks in Paris and the shootings in San Bernardino, put a number of issues very front of mind. Our first runner-up in the issue is Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of ISIS, and I'm sure you can imagine why we felt that he was worth devoting space to in this context. But when we looked over the arc of 2015, we felt that in certain inarguable ways, it was Chancellor Merkel's year, and that's my shorthand for how we come about making the choice. I will say, though, that we love the arguments, and we welcome debate on this issue, and we have a lot of debate and arguments within our own ranks. It's very hard on such an open question to come up with perfect consensus.
That's Radhika Jones, Deputy Managing Editor of Time magazine. And it's time for our daily look at social media and what's buzzing online. International Edition's G. Abby Lee joins me to bring us up to date. Hi, G.
Hello, Ray.
G, we've had some clear skies here in Washington. Nice to look at and nice for breathing purposes, but that doesn't seem to be the case in China.
Not at all. The 3-day smog alert in Beijing is going strong, and the situation is a lot more serious than many people realize. The Wall Street Journal quoted an analysis released earlier this year which projected the air pollution to prematurely kill more than 250,000 people in major cities throughout China. The Qatar-based Al Jazeera also tweeted, in quotation marks, "The air smells like burned coal."
Not pleasant. Not pleasant at all. And that's certainly not how it should smell like. How is the Chinese media playing all of this up?
From a slightly different angle than the Western media, China's state-run Xinhua News Agency tweeted a series of photos. They're basically photos of someone holding up his phone with pictures of Beijing's iconic buildings on a good day while standing next to the actual buildings under the smog. The tweet reads, "Colorful memory against gray days, so there isn't really a critical note on the situation."
What are some of the hashtags people are using now?
Hashtag smog is the most popular, with more than 1,300 tweets using it, according to the Topsy Analytics website. Hashtag airpocalypse, although very catchy and clever, was used in less than 400 tweets in the same time frame. Ray, some organizations and people are taking a lighter take on the situation. The Onion, which is a news satire organization based in America, tweeted a meme about the smog. It sent out a picture of a woman asking this question: who doesn't want a day off to sit inside and enjoy the fresh air? And the WSJ China Real-Time tweeted a smog-themed web game titled Everybody's Search for Beijing is making the rounds. The journal also reported sales of face masks and air purifiers on a popular online shopping site skyrocketed by more than 140% and 50% respectively in the last 30 days. Ray?
Thank you, G. The International Edition team would like to hear from you, and you can do just that by tweeting us your feedback at VOA underscore IE, or go straight to G at G-A-B-B-E-E. That's J-E-E-A-B-B-E-Y-L-E-E. This is VOA.
One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views. Presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us, free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar at voanews.com, and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. A new television movie looks at a significant moment in country singer Dolly Parton's childhood. It's a story about struggle and the healing power of love and faith. International Edition's Sarah Williams talks about it with Country Hits USA host Nikki Strong.
Well, as the holidays approach here in the United States, many inspiring stories of faith and family come to life on the small screen. One of those TV movies includes the story of one of country music's icons, Dolly Parton. Her new film, Coat of Many Colors, is a snapshot of her life as a 9-year-old girl overcoming a family tragedy while living in poverty in the Great Smoky Mountains of Tennessee in 1955. Nikki Strong of VOA Music is here with more details. Well, Nikki, this movie, Coat of Many Colors, is actually based on Dolly Parton's signature hit of the same name.
Yes, and Dolly Parton says that the song is one of her, actually her favorite song that she has ever written. It was released in October 1971 from the album of the same name. And the song itself tells a story of how her mom stitched together a coat for Dolly made out of rags that were given to her family. And as she sewed the coat, her mom would share the biblical story of Joseph and his coat of many colors, in which his father Jacob or Israel gave Joseph this fancy coat as a gift because Joseph was his favorite son. And Joseph, like Dolly, is also one out of 12 children. However, when Dolly wore this coat to school, she was ridiculed and teased about it. But by the end of the song, she realizes that despite being poor, according to the world standards, that coat was far richer than all the material gain in the world. Now, in the movie, we get a deeper meaning behind the song. Dolly has never been ashamed of where she's come from. Her dad and her mom married as teenagers. They were dirt poor. Her dad never had a chance to go to school, but he was a hard worker. And she says her mom had a faith that would move mountains and a love for her dad that just would not quit. And Dolly says that her mother would give each of her siblings a baby. You know, this is your baby, meaning you'll take care of him, you'll feed him, you'll change the diapers. Well, the baby that was supposed to be Dolly's dies. Oh. And her mother goes into a deep depression. And then during this time is when she makes the coat for Dolly. And so the coat then becomes symbolic of stitching the pieces of life back together after this loss. And once Dolly starts getting teased for wearing it, it also becomes a means of personal transformation as little Dolly learns to determine her own self-worth versus anchoring her worth in the shallow opinions of others. So the coat really becomes an anchor in the film, signifying resiliency, renewal, faith, and most importantly, love.
So tell us about the cast. Dolly Parton handpicked many of the actors.
Yeah, Dolly picked Ricky Schroeder to play her father. She said he reminded her so much of her father. She said he looks like his people, his body structure. And Ricky Schroeder and his wife actually lost a child too. So doing the film really hit home for his family as well. Country music star Jennifer Nettles plays her mom. I was surprised by this too. Dolly says Jennifer sent her an audition tape and she flipped out. She said when she heard Jennifer reading the role, she thought, oh my Lord, that's mama. And she said that people are going to be blown away by Jennifer's performance. Olivia Lynn plays Dolly as a child, and she was chosen out of hundreds of children. And Dolly's sister is in it too. She plays the church lady who brings the rags to make the coat.
This film is also the first in a series Dolly Parton is doing with NBC.
Yeah, it is. Coat of Many Colors is the first in a series of movies Dolly is making. Jolene, based on her 1974 hit, will be the next film.
I love that song.
Oh my God, very different story. That's going to be juicy. I can't wait. Coat of Many Colors airs December 10th, 9 p.m. Eastern on NBC. And you can actually take a look at a lengthy preview of it on our Facebook page. You can just go to VOA Music and you can get a sneak peek there.
You can hear music from Dolly Parton and many other country music artists on Country Hits USA with Nikki Strong. You can also reach Nikki on Twitter at @VOA_music or on Facebook at VOA Music. Thanks, Nikki.
Thank you.
There were rags of many colors, but every piece was small, and I didn't have a coat, and it was way down in the fall. Mama sewed the rags together, so in every piece with love, she made my coat of many colors that I was so proud of. As she sewed, she
That'll do it for this edition of International Edition. You can get news, features, videos, podcasts, and much more at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On December 10, 1948, still stunned by the horrendous crimes committed against civilian populations during the Second World War, the United Nations General Assembly adopted the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. At the time, one of the Declaration's chief architects, former First Lady and member of the United States delegation to the United Nations, Eleanor Roosevelt, wrote, "We have found that the conditions of our contemporary world require the enumeration of certain protections which the individual must have if he is to acquire a sense of security and dignity in his own person." Since 1950, the United Nations has celebrated December 10th as Human Rights Day. This day is best known for the Nobel Peace Prize award ceremony in Oslo, Norway. However, cultural events and exhibitions focused on various human rights themes take place around the world. This year's Human Rights Day marks the launch of a year-long campaign to highlight and preview the 50th anniversary of two important human rights documents, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. Both documents were adopted by the UN General Assembly on December 16, 1966. Despite the tireless efforts and notable successes of numerous national and international agencies, non-governmental organizations, and activists all over the world, there is still much to be done. On this Human Rights Day, let us resolve to work together as a community of like-minded nations to put an end to these abuses and to hold those responsible for inflicting them to account. Ultimately, our goal is to transform our observation of December 10th as a day not about highlighting human rights abuses across the globe, but rather about commemorating the realization of full and unobstructed human rights for all people everywhere.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.